University of Colorado.
Welcome to CU On the Air, the University of Colorado's podcast. We feature faculty from across CU's four campuses and their interesting, innovative, and sometimes life-changing work. We're excited about all the great information we got to share with our listeners and learned ourselves this year from CU On the Air guests, University of Colorado professors with a wide range of expertise. We're looking back at some of the highlights of 2018, things that truly resonated with our audience, but also had an impact on us. We started the year talking with Dr. Jay Lemery at the CU Anschutz Medical Campus, who researches the effects of climate change on health. Something we continue to see here in Colorado and around the globe is extreme weather, hurricanes, drought, heat, and Dr. Lemery clues us in on what we'll see coming up and how it will affect us. What aspects of climate change are we seeing here in Colorado, particularly as it relates to health?
Well, we're seeing wildfires. We're seeing worsening extreme precipitation events. When you think about the floods in Boulder a few years ago, I mean, the impact to property and human life was palpable. We're seeing increased drought. We're always at the risk of decreased snowpack, and that has real downstream implications for agricultural areas and, again, food supply. So we're certainly not immune. And this is sort of a pattern that's playing out all over the American West.
Despite things like the terrible hurricane season we saw this year, wildfires, many people still view climate change as kind of an abstract thing that's out there in the future. Does linking it with health make it more real?
Absolutely. Climate change has historically been messaged through altruism. So, you know, love Mother Earth, you know, save the whales, or abstractions. Parts per million of carbon dioxide hit 400. What does that mean for most people? Science communication has generally failed in this regard, and now I think when you bring it to an issue where you can talk about the health of your family and your kids' risk of asthma, that has a whole nother meaning for people.
Are some of these extreme weather events shoving it more into the mainstream?
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, it takes a crisis or a tragedy or an extreme event to get people to pay attention to it, right? So I think what happened, you know, in Houston this year and, you know, Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands and then the wildfires, I think more and more people are realizing that these are not isolated events, but it's part of a greater pattern. So with that comes a chance to reassess, and hopefully we're understanding that this is a problem that we're going to have to face head on. And I think viewing it through a healthcare lens helps us really see the impact in a way that everyone can relate to.
An end-of-year roundup gives us a chance for updates. In April, we talked with CU Denver professor Lila Tolerand about the Green Roofs initiative Denver voters had passed in November of 2017. Since then, the initiative has been revised to better suit the Colorado climate to reduce the urban heat island effect. We chatted about how the heat island effect and cool roofs are important.
So you know Colorado. Just within a day or two, we have these extreme variances. And green roofs can help mitigate some of these temperature variances. They add a layer of insulation and help cool the building in the summer and heat the building in the winter. Some of the savings that comes with the reduction in heating cooling, you can translate into water savings. So again, in Colorado, we talk about green roofs that are arid. They use plants that are low water, that are adapted to this climate, adapted to this extreme freeze-thaw cycle, and use quite small amounts of irrigation. The Denver Botanic Gardens has a number of studies. They have a website you can go in and see over 100 plants that they've tested over the past 10 years and see the survival rate. And you can see irrigation amounts last year and 3 years ago, for example. They didn't irrigate their green roof at all because we had enough precipitation. This business of that the green roof layer actually can protect the building. So again, these extreme freeze-thaw cycles that we have for roof membranes is detrimental. We have a blast of UV light in this climate that is unreal for any kind of material. Hail. So instead of putting all this money into re-roofing after a hailstorm, if we have green roofs and green infrastructures, that actually is a buffer. And many of the plants that we recommend that are adapted to this climate, that are stress tolerant, are also adapted to a hailstorm. Denver is the number three on the list for hottest cities, the number one problem of urban heat island effect. We're just behind Albuquerque and Las Vegas. And I think the people of Denver, we just want a better city than that. We're 11th on the list for air pollution. I think that people just want to take on ownership of the climate in their cities.
May's podcast hit close to home as I talk with my boss, CU President Bruce Benson, on his decade plus as president of the university. He chatted about what's been done and what's to come for CU. He announced last summer he'll be retiring from CU and handing over the reins to a new president come July. The search for his replacement is underway.
It's a tough job. You've got to work with every kind of constituency you can think of. And you know, you have shared governance. So you got students, faculty, staff, and you've got your administration and they want to do it. And you've got the Board of Regents. You have to use your political smarts to make sure and get things done. So that's what it comes down to. But then you go farther. We have to worry about fundraising. So you got all kinds of constituencies around the country that you have to talk to and worry about. You've got the state legislature. You've got the business community. You've got all kinds of organizations that are part of this, and you have to pay attention to all of them. And we continue to bring in more students and higher quality students on all our campuses. Applications are up. They're the highest I think they've ever have been here. And they've been increasing on the Boulder campus, for one example, about 4,000 per month, just the increase. So it's getting much more selective and hard to get in. We get about 5% of our total budget from the state. And when I started, we were about $228 million of state funding. We dropped all the way down to 145, I believe, and worked our way back to 185 or so now. And throw in growth of student population, which is around 18% over this period of time, and inflation, and we're way behind. So what have we done about that? We've had to go out and make this place efficient. And, you know, and there's still more. We just need to go find it. And you look at the other state. We passed legislation to get out of the state procurement system. In fact, we did such a good job on it, we suggested the state join our system after we got done with that and said, look, you can save money this way. Well, they didn't join us, but they at least went out and rebid everything and got their costs down because that's good for the state of Colorado. I look at our research funding. I believe we're about $660 million when we started, and now we're at over $1 billion and continuing to grow as far as I know. And I look at the private philanthropy. They were raising $135 million a year, and we kind of ripped the place up and restarted it and rearranged, restructured, and brought in a lot of different people. Last year was $386 million. I'm quite certain we're going to easily break $400 this year, and we aren't even done yet. I had no idea if I was going to be here 3 years or 5 years or 10 years or anything else when I started. I just said, we've got a lot of stuff that needs to be worked on. A lot of things need fixing. A lot of things need to be made more efficient. And I just said, let's go after it and do it. But it's a collaborative effort. It's not one person doing these things. The reason I can be reasonably successful here is that I've got a wife who really puts her heart into it. She's a very accomplished woman. But the intellectual abilities that she brings are huge. And, you know, people are constantly saying, what would you do, Marcy? And she has the answer. So I couldn't do the job without her. And she's a just heck of a partner, and I couldn't be more proud of her.
An episode many of us related to featured CU Denver professor Stan Sutcher, an entertainment attorney who discussed legal battles ranging from Beatlemania to the Me Too movement. We talked about everything from the exploitation of artists, the Beatles, other musicians' legal woes, how litigation kills creativity, right down to what we can expect to see from Elvis and Roy Orbison on hologram tours.
It's been a blast because entertainment law is an area that covers a lot of issues, a lot of areas, contracts, right of publicity, trademarks, royalties, you name it. Today, digital media law, all those rights, music streaming, those are being carved out by courts all the time. I was able to get all this and put it into one, and really that's a kind of a long way of saying that's how I became so interested in entertainment law. Artists didn't have a lot of sources of information in those earlier years. And when I was doing it late 70s into the 80s, you know, doing a lot of music journalism, And then also interviewing artists later as an entertainment law journalist, I discovered they usually weren't that sophisticated, but also they had to deal with the issue of unequal bargaining power as they were getting their careers off the ground, the contracts they signed. When you put those two things together, a lack of legal sophistication with the bargaining power on the other side, the record company, a manager who drafts a contract and hands it to an artist to sign, the odds against staying a successful artist and making sure that your finances and legal rights are in order is really quite a challenge.
Speaking of major artists, you've written a book, Baby, You're a Rich Man, Suing the Beatles for Fun and Profit. The Beatles were a lightning rod for a lot of lawsuits, and I think here is a prototypical story of four lads from Liverpool who all of a sudden are the biggest thing in the world, and that seems like that was the moment where some of their legal problems started.
Their first manager, Brian Epstein, had no management experience. Of course, he was from Liverpool like the Beatles. He was in the record retail business. He was very successful at that. He was the largest record retail account in that part of Northwest England. But when he saw the Beatles at the Cavern Club and signed them, he really didn't know much about the industry beyond record retailing. So that led to a lot of issues for the Beatles right away, particularly because once they signed with him, it wasn't that much longer after that that Beatlemania happened, that they really hit it big. You know, he signs them in 1962 as a manager, and in 1963, they have three number one hits in England. And by the end of that year, in October, they do a show in London where the fans are outside going wild over them. And the press the very next day coins the phrase, the British press, Beatlemania. So you can imagine that gets the attention out of a lot of so-called industry sharks. What have we got here? Let's take a look at the Beatles. And so they did indeed end up all through the years in lots of different legal disputes and legal challenges that have really are really cautionary tales even today for artists.
Local DJ here sued Taylor Swift after she accused him of groping her. Any surprises about that case?
The legal issue was very straightforward. The evidence was straightforward with the backstage photo of the former DJ touching Taylor Swift and what she said, what they ruled was sexual assault. So from a legal perspective, it was a fairly straightforward case. But, you know, she made a statement, I'm only asking for a dollar in damages. And it's not that long ago in terms of the Me Too movement. There she was last year in one of the cover of Time magazine with one of the people of the year. So it was a statement case that really is part of this trend and is a key part of this trend, really brought a lot of attention to what became the Me Too movement and the issue of sexual harassment in the entertainment industry.
We caught up with CU Boulder engineering professor Paul Chinowski to explore a popular past president of the university. George Norlin was the longest serving president of CU from 1919 to 1939. He was soft-spoken, yet he stood up to the pressures of prejudice. And although CU was penalized by the state, we were then and still are proud of Norlin's stand.
It's interesting, if I was writing a movie script, I don't think I could have written one that was more the American story than George Norlin. He was born literally in a sod house on the prairie in Kansas. His parents were Swedish immigrants. Today we would say they lost everything in a bad real estate deal, but they came out and started over. He was there with his brother's seven kids. They survived an Indian attack by crawling into a hollow log. His father decided that Concordia, Kansas got too many people and they moved to Green Bay, Wisconsin. He grew up fishing, outdoorsman. His mother died when he was young. And very unusually, he kept with school for that time, went to high school and on to college in Nebraska, and became one of the foremost scholars of Greek at that time, went to Greece, really studied the Peloponnesian Wars. He really was interested in Athenians and the start of democracy and their fight internally in Greece, which really shaped a lot of what his thought was, is how great civilizations could be torn apart when discourse stopped and how, what we could learn from that.
There were some unique circumstances that led to him being acting president and then president.
Yeah, in 1917, Livingston Ferrand, who was the president of the university, who was a doctor, was called to Europe to head the Tuberculosis Commission during World War I to try and figure out how they could contain that. He was appointed interim president or acting president while Livingston Ferrand was in Europe. President Ferrand never came back. He stayed. He became head of the Red Cross. And the faculty were asked to vote, and they voted unanimously to make George Norland president in 1919.
One of the most courageous things he did is what he's perhaps best known for, which is standing up to the KKK and the then governor who threatened the university. Talk about that episode.
Back at that time, 1925, the state of Colorado was really controlled politically by the KKK. It was one of the largest areas where the KKK was. We had about 50,000 members in Colorado. It was not unusual in Boulder and other towns around here to have cross burnings on the weekend, to have large parades down the main streets with people in hoods. It was really a time when the KKK was strong. They controlled the governor's office. They were trying to get control of the state legislature. We were at a tipping point, and the governor basically said to George Norland, either you get rid of all the Jews and Catholics on your staff, or we're going to take away your funding. And George Norland said, it is our job as a university to hire the people that we think are best to educate students. And he would not back down. And he said, if you want to take away our funding, go ahead. But we're not going to clear the campus like this. And sure enough, the next year, 1925, that fiscal year, the state legislature withheld $125,000 from the university, which at the time was a huge part of the budget. George Norland sat down with the faculty, with the staff. He said, we're going to work together. We're going to tighten our belts. We're going to hold our budgets. We're not going to take raises. We're going to make cuts, and we're going to get through this because it's what's important for the students. And they did that. They held together. And the next year, the budget came back. And it was actually one of the key points where the KKK lost really its control in Colorado. If there was nothing else that we remember about George Norland, we can always go back and say, above all else, it was what was good for the university.
We reached far beyond our campuses to Spain to Skype with CU Colorado Springs history professor Roger Martinez about his MOOC centered on medieval Spain and the coexistence between Jews, Christians, and Muslims. It was a timely topic as it explores the good and bad of coexistence of different belief systems and looked at the past to make sure mistakes aren't made again.
I started teaching MOOCs, massive open online courses. And as some of your listeners might know, these are these large online courses that attract thousands and thousands of students where we deliver college level education for free. And you can reach, you know, literally over 100 nations, all kinds of folks. Well, what if you could make this implicit trade with students, which is, let me teach you about this fabulous history of medieval Spain, because it looks remarkably like our modern world. Jews, Christians, and Muslims all lived in this small country, and they coexisted somehow or another together. What if you teach about this really fascinating history, but also simultaneously ask students to learn how to read old Spanish handwriting, which is called paleography. It's the study of handwriting. And in return, what we do is kind of create a collaborative endeavor where we're working with students across the world of all ages, from 18 years of age to folks that are retired and ask them to basically help you decipher manuscripts, decipher secrets. And so the EU took a look at the project and they thought, we think this is pretty neat. So for the last 3 years, I've been crisscrossing the country working inside of cathedral archives and municipal archives and pulling manuscripts that are some as old as 1,000 years old. And we're starting to investigate those to identify what was the nature of day-to-day relationships between Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And some of the exciting things that are kind of come out of that is that we see is coexistence is kind of a different than we expect it to be. So that's what I'm doing here in Madrid, is basically implementing this EU grant and trying to bring medieval Spain to the world and then also find new discoveries inside the manuscripts. I think what Christian kings and also Muslim kings in Spain came to realize is that if you want to have a successful community, you need to have everybody participating in it. So the rule of law is very important. So, for instance, in Islamic Spain, and we know from 711 to 1492, some portion of Spain was always under Islamic control. So this is 8 centuries of Muslim kind of governance. And the Muslims brought something really interesting to Spain in terms of governance. What we know is the Muslims practiced a type of law that allowed Jews and Christians to practice their religions freely. Now, they couldn't proselytize and try to convert other people, and they couldn't, you know, worship publicly at the outside, but they were allowed to keep their religions. And that was a guaranteed right.
Mental health is a growing concern on campuses and throughout communities in Colorado and beyond. We talk with Matt Vogel, Executive Director of the National Mental Health Innovation Center at the CU Anschutz Medical Campus, about his own experiences and what needs to be done to prevent and treat depression and other mental health challenges. An interesting insight was how virtual reality is helping save lives.
You've been doing a lot of work with virtual reality. How does that fit in?
So virtual reality, it's very interesting. So we have had the opportunity to study virtual reality and its ability to be an effective tool for behavior change for about 30 years. So we know it's effective for all kinds of things like doing exposure therapy and treating people who have phobias, treating PTSD, where you can recreate a situation, you know, like you know, virtual Iraq or virtual World Trade Center, and take the people that suffered trauma there back so that they can identify what their triggers are. It's great for meditation. We know that meditation is great for all kinds of things in life, but it's hard to do when you know, it's really hard to shut out the outside world for people. You know, anybody who's tried it knows that can be a real challenge. And VR takes care of that for you because you put on the headset. We can put you on a beach, in the woods, or wherever.
And I did a demonstration of your one for people with fear of flying, and it was quite effective. I could see how it really helped folks.
Some of the outcomes and the responses to VR have just been amazing. You know, anybody that is interested in trying it should come to our center, and we're happy to give demos anytime people want. But, you know, VR really operates on the hierarchy of our senses, and that, you know, visual is more powerful than anything else, and we believe what we see. So that even, you know, for example, if I put you on the top of a building in a virtual reality setting, even though you know intellectually you're on the floor and you can't get hurt, fight or flight kicks in on your brain because your brain said, nope, I'm seeing something different and you're not safe. So I'm going to make your heart rate go up. I'm going to make your knees tremble and all the things that I can throw at you to keep you safe and to keep you from getting out of that elevator onto the edge of the building where it's not safe. So it's a very, very effective tool.
Given the prevalence of mental health issues, we all know someone or are someone who have had issues, and you've had some experiences yourself that inform your work. Can you tell us about that?
Definitely. You're right. I say it all, and I really believe this. I don't think there's a person in this country that has not been affected by mental illness in one way or another. Either they themselves have experienced it, or they've seen a family member or a loved one or a coworker who has dealt with depression or anxiety or has maybe experienced suicide. For myself, I have bipolar disorder, type 2, and looking back, I think, you know, the initial onset, as it often is, happened for me when I was in undergraduate at school at Marquette. And like a lot of people, people with bipolar. I just ignored it for a long, long time. And I allowed it to get worse and worse. And what happens is very often as the depression side of bipolar comes back, it gets a little deeper, a little darker. You know, depression is kind of like when the brakes are going out on your own car and you don't notice it. And it's not till somebody else gets in your car and like, oh my God, this thing doesn't stop, because it's gradual. And so when you're suffering, you know, that downward spiral, and when I was going through that, I didn't even notice that it was getting worse and worse. But I was losing hope, and I was really becoming convinced that the only way to ease my pain was to take my own life. And so I got to a point where, you know, when I hit what I thought was rock bottom, I went out and purchased a gun and wrote a note. And thankfully, I had a neighbor who saw what was going on, and she saw me crying one day, the day that I was planning to take my life, and intervened. And she wouldn't take no for an answer initially. I said, no, I'm fine. And she's like, no, you're not. I know you well enough, and what's going on. And I broke down, and she was able to get me to the hospital and you know, start putting my life back together. So it really ended up being, you know, kind of the greatest day of my life. And I made a decision a few years ago to be very open about it, because for a long time I kept it hidden. You know, bipolar is not something that people generally brag about. I didn't want to be to bring the stigma on my family. The reality is that if we're going to deal with stigma, it's critical for the people that are successful and are doing well managing these conditions to be open about it.
This podcast featuring Dr. Robert Valick from the CU Anschutz Medical Campus was terrifying and enlightening. Dr. Valick is a leading expert on the opioid crisis, and we chatted about how we got here, what has been put in place in Colorado and the nation to start the long road to recovery. Dr. Valick gave our audiences some great reasons to get rid of unused drugs and alternatives to using opioids in the first place.
It does. The problem dates back probably 25 or 30 years to the mid-80s when I was in training, so I remember it well. The conversation was, we're under-treating pain. We have effective medications like opioids that are underused, and whether this is just day-to-day pains, acute pain from an injury or post-surgical pain or cancer pain, any sort, we're under-treating it. And maybe we're opiophobic was a word that was batted around 30 years ago. Over the intervening couple of decades, from probably the mid-80s to the early 2000s, there were a lot of things that came together. Pain became called the fifth vital sign. The American Pain Society launched a campaign to do this. As it turns out, that wasn't practitioners leading the charge. That was the United States pharmaceutical industry leading the charge that was financing the development of those campaigns to make pain the fifth vital sign. And there was a lot of promotion of opioids by companies like Purdue Pharma that launched OxyContin in the early 90s, very successfully, with some of the best pharmaceutical marketers in history that developed and launched drugs like Valium and Librium and other products in the 50s and 60s, and used the same marketing techniques to very effectively market opioids to doctors. All these things coming together, we call it a perfect storm, that led to a lot of opioid prescribing, such that from the 80s to about the early 2000s, in a 15-year span, we quintupled the amount of opioids prescribed in this country per capita. So we used them rarely in the 80s. Some people would argue not enough. I would argue probably just about right. I was one of those opiophobic people. I just thought we were doing things okay then. And now we've swung over to the point where now we consume over 80% of the world's opioids. 98% of the world's oxycodone, the OxyContin product, is consumed here. Virtually no one else in the world uses opioids the way we do.
How does heroin factor into this big picture?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways that it does. One is that some people, the most common way people start on opioids is from some exposure that a doctor writes them a prescription. It's also very common, like I said, for people to non-medically use, people who end up overdosing or going into treatment, and we can ask them where they started. 70% of people say they used the leftovers from someone's medicine cabinet. 17% say they used their own leftovers. So that's almost 90% of this comes from the leftover stuff. You ask people who are in treatment for heroin abuse, they're in treatment, where did you start? 75% of them say, I started with prescribed opioids. Nobody picks up a needle one day and starts using heroin out of the blue. People start down a pathway, and most often it's the leftovers from the medicine cabinet pathway that eventually people run out of those. They have to go to the doctor and try to get some, buy them from their friends, take them from their friends, and when those things run out, go buy heroin because it's cheaper. So that's one big path. The other path is the fact that it's just true that the Sinaloan cartel, in the western half of the United States anyway, controls the black tar heroin market, and it's a very robust market. and the price of heroin is much cheaper, probably 20 to 25% of what it costs to get prescribed opioid pills on the street. So it's much cheaper to get black tar heroin, and which virtually must always be injected. So then we have an injection drug use problem and a heroin problem running simultaneously. Some people being shifted that way, some people just going over because it's much cheaper to get heroin. Everyone knows where to go get the opioids, which is in your medicine cabinet. With the numbers of pills going out every year, virtually every American medicine cabinet has opioids sitting in it. And we need to get rid of them and dispose of them properly, and helps, you know, solve that 87% of people that use the leftovers. If we could all just do that, we could make a huge dent in this problem.
How do you encourage people to do that?
And it's, again, good question. We have a program now in Colorado, one of the few states that does this, what's called takemedsback.org. And we have all over the state permanent collection boxes that look like mailboxes or FedEx kind of boxes that are very secured, that are in pharmacies or law enforcement departments, like a police department or sheriff's office, where you can simply go in and drop your medications in the slot, and it's secured, and those get taken and destroyed at an EPA-certified incinerator, so they can't fall into the wrong hands, no one can use the leftovers, and you will have just shut the door on someone finding those leftovers and getting started.
CU Colorado Springs professor Christopher Bell, a superhero fan, realized a few years back that his daughter, also a superhero fan, wasn't finding any female hero action figures, costumes, or lunchboxes. He did a TED Talk on the topic in 2015, and things began to turn around. Now he is a diversity and inclusive consultant for Pixar Animation Studios.
In 2015, I was invited to give this TED Talk about my research, and I gave a talk about how I, as a father of a daughter who is also a big science fiction fan, superhero fan, Star Wars fan, I found it problematic that whenever I would see my kid playing, she was always dressing up as boys. She was dressing up as, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi or as Darth Maul or, you know, as she loved the Incredible Hulk, and all these characters that she really loved were all boys. And I began to realize that the problem was, while there were lots of female superheroes, there wasn't really a whole lot of female superhero stuff. The same kinds of toys you would find for boys and costumes and all that paraphernalia didn't really exist for female superheroes. And so she was sort of forced into this space where she had to play as a boy. And so I did this TED Talk about how I thought that was a problem, and it got picked up by TED, and it became a global feature, and it sort of went viral for a couple of weeks. And in that couple of weeks, I got a phone call from a woman who said, "Hi, I'm the head of education at Pixar Animation Studios." And I kind of did one of those, "Well, no, you're not. And who are you really? And what's the deal?
What are you trying to sell me?"
And she did the thing that you only see in movies, which was she was like, "Hang up and call this number." So I hung up and I called the number back, and it was Pixar Animation Studios. So I talked to her, and she said, "We'd like to invite you out to come and talk to some of our animators about the work that you do." Now, in the consulting work that I'm doing, they send me character sketches of films that aren't going to come out for 4 or 5 years from now. You know, they'll send me character sketches and ask me, "What do I think of these?" And I say, "Well, does it matter if this character is a boy? What happens if you change this character to a girl? Or if you give this character brown skin, does that change the story at all? Or who are you thinking of casting for this? And maybe you should think in this direction." And so now I really am sort of in a position where I am able at some low level to gently move the tide, so to speak, of how Pixar is making movies, of who they are putting in their movies, and of whose voices are being heard, and of the representation that we see on the screen. When the director and producer of Coco went on stage at the Oscars to accept the Academy Award for Best Animated Picture for Coco, they literally word for word quoted me.
"With Coco, we tried to take a step forward toward a world where all children can grow up seeing characters in movies that look and talk and live like they do. Marginalized people deserve to feel like they belong. Representation matters."
My phone blew up. we were all watching the television and my phone just started ringing off the hook. And it was all these people who are like, I've heard you say those words before. You know, I've sat in classes with you and heard you say those things. And so, you know, it's resonating at some of the highest levels in Pixar right now, which to me is everything I wanted to do with my research. Pixar is a multi-billion dollar corporation and your kids grew up on that. Someone ought to be advising them. And I'm happy that that gets to be me.
Most recently, we talked to CU Boulder professor and celebrated horror writer Stephen Graham Jones about zombie love, werewolves, why people would possibly want to be scared, and the powerful outcome behind slasher stories. Professor Jones shared that writers sometimes have to go beyond their comfort zone in writing horror and other genres, including crime, sci-fi, and experimental fiction.
I do scare myself. It could be that I have a low threshold. I get scared quite easily. A lot of horror authors I talk to say they no longer get scared because they understand the mechanisms now. They understand the tricks. It's all parlor games. It's never turned into that for me. I often write in order to divest myself of what I consider to be scary images or terrifying ideas. But what I find is that when I put them on the page, that just gives them more detail, makes them more real. As for how I tap into that, I take it as my job as a horror writer to always go one more step into the darkness than the reader would go his or herself. They're paying $1 or $25 or whatever it is to engage this story I've written. And because of that, I'm beholden to walk out past where I'm comfortable walking and take them with me and then blow the candle out. On the page, dread is going to be your friend more than terror. Terror works really good at the Cineplex, the jump scares. But dread is that long, slow ramp up to a spike of terror. And the difference in terror and dread is sitting on the couch waiting for someone to knock at the door. Terror is opening the door and seeing who they are. And fiction gets a lot more mileage out of sitting on the couch and waiting for that door to knock.
Horror has been a genre of fiction for a long time, and a lot of the stories seem to have similar themes. You know, there's been vampire stories and werewolf stories throughout the centuries. How have they evolved over that time?
You know, when the werewolf story first started really getting popular, or going viral, I guess we'd call it, probably back around the 15th, 16th century, it was being used differently than when we use it now. Back then, what would happen was different lords would battle and ravage the countryside, burn all the crops, kill all the cattle, leave the people living out there starving. And so a certain small percentage of those people would turn to attacking people on the roadways in order to eat, and they would eat those people sometimes. They would say when they were caught, it wasn't me, I'm a werewolf, I'm not responsible for my actions. And so nowadays we would call them serial killers. Back then, you could like put on a werewolf shroud and hide behind that. You still got punished, but you weren't the same kind of guilty, I don't think. Whereas nowadays, the werewolf stories we tell ourselves have more to do with the fact that we live in a world that's so sterilized and lit up that we need prompting and reminding that we have animal urges inside of us that we need to let run every once in a while.
A big thank you to all our listeners and all our guests. We look forward to sharing a lot more insight and faculty research highlights in 2019. Happy New Year. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the air. Thank you for joining us for See You on the Air. The University of Colorado comprises four campuses: Boulder, Colorado Springs, Denver, and the CU Anschutz Medical Campus in Aurora. To learn more about CU, go to www.cu.edu. Thanks to our producer, Kathy Buten, and audio engineer, John Arnold. I'm Ken McConnellog, and we'll see you on the air next month.
University of Colorado.